You may proceed.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
My name is Casey Murray. I'm an attorney at Spencer Fane Britton Brown. We represent the mother in this termination of parental rights case. This is a case where the family court commissioner issued findings and recommendations that were accepted by the trial court, wherein the family court commissioner determined that mother, as best we can tell, because the court's decision did not specifically delineate the statutes it was relying upon, but as best we can tell, was terminating mother's parental rights due to mother's mental condition, mother's failure to support, failure to rectify, and parental unfitness. Three of the four, all but the failure to support, were based upon its findings of mother's mental condition. This court has provided that when determining whether a mental condition warrants termination, the trial court should consider three factors. Should consider the documentation, whether the condition is supported by sufficient and competent evidence. The duration, whether the condition is permanent, such as there is a reasonable likelihood that it can be reversed. And the severity, whether it's so severe as to render the parent unable to knowingly provide the child with the necessary care, custody, and control. The trial court's decision failed to provide competent, clear, cogent, convincing evidence in all three standards, all three factors. For example, the documentation of mother's mental condition. The court relied almost exclusively on two 2009 reports. The first were the records from Children's Mercy Hospital in 2009. This was the incident that led to the state taking custody of the child. Mother was suffering an isolated delusional episode and brought her happy, well clean, well-fed, cared-for baby to the hospital. While there, she made a number of outlandish statements. The trial court focused its decision almost exclusively on, 12 of the 77 paragraphs focused in great detail on that incident. The other documentation of mother's mental condition was a 2009 report by Dr. Bill McDonald. This report occurred shortly after the incident. This report also occurred before mother began seeing her therapist, which she saw regularly throughout the duration of this case. It continues. Before she began seeing a psychiatrist, before she got on medication.
But did the court also rely upon evidence from a parent aide and from mother herself? Mother testified that she still believed it was possible that she and the child were administered medication of some kind that caused them to be sexually assaulted without their knowledge. I mean, she was continuing the same delusion even during trial.
She had the delusion, and as her psychiatrist testified, Dr. Stanley Golan, as he testified, that is a part of her mental condition. It was a delusional episode, is what he called it. And that's a fixed delusional belief that something happened. Dr. Golan also testified that people with this condition, it's a fixed belief of what happened, but it doesn't affect their life ongoing. And in fact, a past act such as that belief can be used as evidence, but as this court's well aware, there must be, for a past act, there must be an explicit consideration of how the past act indicates a likelihood of future harm. In this case, we have mother's statements and her belief, but mother never harmed the child. And her own psychiatrist testified, well, yes, this belief does not worry me. I'm not concerned that she will harm the child in the future, which is a key component.
Are you saying, sort of, as a matter of law, we should say that a single delusional episode is inadequate?
I would think not as a matter of law, but it would depend on the facts of the delusional episode. Obviously, if it's a delusional episode where something horrible happens, that carries more weight than a delusional episode where, at the height of the delusion, the mother took her baby to the hospital.
Even though she still continues to believe that it actually happened.
And that's part of her condition. That the psychiatrist testified this is what happens when people have delusional.
You can still be a good parent if you have a delusional belief that there's climate change, or you have a delusional belief there's evolution.
Exactly.
You can still be a good parent. You can, there are those delusions.
That's exactly correct. You can believe that aliens landed at Area 51, but if it's not affecting your parenting, it's a delusional belief that's unrelated to, or that That doesn't mean it can't be a parent in the future. That's exactly correct.
And didn't the parent aid also indicate that it was not appropriate for a mother to be reunified with the child?
At various points, the parent aid expressed a belief, especially near the end, that she did not believe, the parent aid did not believe it was appropriate. However, the parent aid's opinion, and going back to the trial court's findings and recommendations, the trial court didn't say, well, I'm basing this on the parent aid, I'm basing this on mother's mental condition. And the mental condition needs to be supported by clear, cogent, convincing evidence. A parent aid is not a trained psychiatrist, or is not a medical doctor who's able
to
make...
Well, she diagnoses schizophrenia. Sometimes you could have a diagnosis which wouldn't get stale over years, because let's say they say she's schizophrenic. Well, she's probably schizophrenic now, probably schizophrenic 3 years ago.
Yes, that's correct. And in this case, the evidence relied upon the court was from 2009 for a hearing 3 years later.
But why couldn't the court find that it was a permanent mental condition and therefore hadn't changed in that time? And why wasn't it up to the court to decide how much weight to give it?
The court, had evidence been presented that it was a continuing, ongoing, permanent mental condition, the court could have found that. But well, that isn't what the testimony was presented.
Why couldn't the court find that based upon her own testimony that she... I believe that it was still true.
Doing so ignores Dr. Golan's testimony, Dr. Golan's medical expert opinion, which was uncontroverted, and no other medical expert testified relating to explain, saying, well, this is my contrary opinion.
But you're saying the court had to accept it if there's only one expert? And I know there's a discussion mm-hmm. in the briefs on this, but we're not dealing with the physical condition, but with how dangerous her mental state is. If there's only one expert, it's contrary to the evidence not to accept it?
Well, in this case, when we're looking at a past act, an isolated past act from 2009 on one hand, versus a psychiatrist's testimony who saw the patient the month of the trial, that if you're going to counter that psychiatrist's testimony, there should be more than just a 2009 incident.
But the court found that Dr. Golan's testimony was not credible.
He believed that it was not credible, and he described why. He basically said that Dr. Golan's care was below the standard review. He said, I don't believe he met with her enough, and he was relying on her testimony, which is him making a medical diagnosis. There was no testimony presented as to how a proper or how a what the standard of care should be for a psychiatrist.
Was there an objection to his testimony?
No.
Okay, so if there's no objection to the foundation of that testimony, then the court can believe it or not believe it. Same way with the parent aid, right? There's no objection. The court takes it for what it's worth, gives it weight or doesn't give it weight.
Yes.
What's the difference between those two?
Well, in this case, the court is making a medical diagnosis.
But why? Why is that a medical? I understand the earlier case where it was causation of an injury and it was a medical case. Mm-hmm. It was a medical diagnosis we said was improper. But why is that what was done here? Why wouldn't it just, I don't have to believe his testimony that it's not going to present continuing problems?
Because there was no other evidence to support that opinion. For example, the severity of mother's purported mental condition, where there needs to be, it needs to be shown that it's so severe the parent's incapable of providing even minimally acceptable care. In this case, mother again presented, well, there's a change in circumstances.
So what if this guy had just seen the mother for 10 minutes right before trial, and the trial court said, I don't think that's enough? Would the trial court be making a medical diagnosis?
If there was evidence presented saying you need more than the 10-minute diagnosis, yes.
But the Angus case that you're relying upon, the language in that case talked about whether or not this person had a particular kind of arthritis, and the mm-hmm. court characterized that as a complex medical issue. You just said that the decision that the trial court had to make here was whether or not mother could provide at least minimal care. Is that a complex medical issue?
For a mental condition, a mental condition is a complex physical issue. It's a person's brain and how
it
works.
But if somebody's able to provide minimal care, isn't that something that maybe trained professionals like social workers, parent aides, other people in that field are competent to testify about and have firsthand knowledge?
That's correct. And in fact, here there was again, uncontroverted testimony. Mother, during the pendency of this case, had another child, had a son, roughly a year prior to the termination hearing. And the son was born in the state of Kansas, and pursuant to the law, the Kansas authorities immediately assumed jurisdiction over the son and began, and the caseworkers fully analyzed and followed mother to determine whether or not she was capable of raising her son. And there was testimony at trial from the Kansas caseworkers saying, well, the Kansas has no concern about how mother is raising her son. We in fact, we are ready to release jurisdiction of this case because we do not have concerns. There's our position, there's no better evidence that a parent is capable of providing minimally acceptable care than the fact that a parent is providing minimally acceptable care to another child.
But there was no evidence that the Kansas CASA worker had any knowledge of the pending Missouri action.
Well, I believe the analysis was, and how I understand it, is the court determined, well, the Kansas workers didn't know about this 2009 incident. They're not focused on these past acts. And they don't know about all these past acts. They're focusing on mother's current condition. That's inappropriate, which is not the standard for determining a parental rights based on mental conditions. It needs to be based on the parent's condition at the time of the termination hearing, not how she was in 2009 when she was suffering it per delusional episode.
Now, they had expert testimony in Kansas that with respect to her ability to take care of the other child?
I believe Dr. Golan was involved in that aspect as well, saying she was capable of, he was under his care in Kansas and Missouri. Quickly, I will just state that on the other ground the court gave was a failure to provide support.
And in the Kansas case, nothing was brought up about the Missouri case?
I don't know the details of the Kansas case. I know the workers knew some of the details, but they weren't provided. They may not have seen each and every individual record.
They had to know something because the existence of the Missouri case is why they took custody
exactly.
of the child.
But the trial courts found that the Kansas service providers had not communicated or received any information from the service providers in Missouri, and that was a finding by the trial court.
That was a finding by the trial court. And again, the trial court determining, well, the Kansas can't be right because they're not focusing on these 2009 incidents.
Well, what he said was that they didn't communicate with the Missouri officials. Didn't necessarily limit it to that. I mean, there may have been other relevant things that they didn't communicate.
That's true.
And the only person who testified regarding the Kansas case was a Kansas CASA volunteer.
That's correct. In her testimony, there was no contrary evidence about how mother was failing to take care of her son, failing to provide mutually acceptable care of her son.
Mm-hmm. And you would have had the ability to call anybody else from Kansas that you wanted to support your position.
That's correct.
And the only witness was the consular.
Yes. I'm out of time, so anyone has any other questions?
You have some time on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Chief Justice Russell, Your Honors, and may it please the court, it's my privilege today to represent the foster family that brought this action in the first place. They're here in court today. It's also my privilege to speak to some extent in behalf of the child's guardian ad litem, who came of her own motion and volition today to be here and recommended that the parental rights be terminated.
Is that report in the record, the guardian ad litem's recommendation?
It is in the transcript. The guardian ad litem did not file a brief due to a medical leave that occurred, but she's here today. She can't argue, but she's here today, Shemaine Mann. But her recommendation is in the transcript at the close of the evidence. Also, I feel like I am representing the recommendations of the juvenile officer and the children's division. I'm representing the defense of the family court decision. Before I talk specifically about the evidence, I think in what seems a surprising linkage to the first case, we must talk a little bit about appellate review. I'm talking to those of you who are experts on appellate review. I understand that. But there are some statutes, there are some some of your own language that guides this court, and some of it's already been referred to in the earlier case. But in section 211.443, this says that the statutes are to be construed so as to promote the best interests and welfare of the child as determined by the juvenile court in consideration of protecting the constitutional rights of all parties, the recognition and protection of the birth-family relationship when possible and appropriate, and the entitlement of every child to a permanent and stable home. And, of course, we know that section paragraph 6 of 221.447 says that when it appears by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that grounds exist for termination pursuant to section 245, termination may be granted. But before that, it says if the court finds that termination is in the best interest of the child. And in the adoption of CMBR, this court said, when the evidence poses two reasonable but different inferences, the court is obligated to defer to the trial court's assessment of the evidence, citing Washington versus Barnes Hospital. Greater deference is granted to the trial court's determination in custody and adoption proceedings than in other cases. We know one reason for that is that these are sensitive cases, and being the trial judge on the spot puts you in a different position to observe the parties, observe the whole situation. In this case, not only did we have that, but we had a commissioner who had lived with this file for 3 years. Now, they were unhappy with him later, but they never requested recusal. They never moved for a change of judge when the adoption case was filed. But this commissioner had lived with this file for 3 years. And in this extensive record with lots of service provider reports, that judge was familiar with those because that judge had presided over decisions on permanency and so on. As you know, there was a desire to move this to permanency with the mother. There was then, when that seemed to be not going well, then there was an attempt to move to permanency with the father. That didn't go well. And so the child remained in foster care for 4 years to this day.
And the child is now 5?
The child will be 5 this month. A 5-year-old has lots of questions about what's happening. What's happening? Where do I fit? How am I safe? How am I stable? How am I secure?
The child's only lived with the mother for 9 months out of the 5 years?
The child lived with the mother a total of 7.75 months out of the 5 years. 5 months of those were before the court exercised jurisdiction. Since the court exercised jurisdiction, in the last 4.5 years, the child has been with the mother for 2.75 months. That came about, as I understand, the record's a little unclear on this, but that came about that she had custody during that time because of the fact that the court wanted, since Kansas had allowed her to regain custody of her son, Jace, the court wanted to get Kansas' opinion on should there be an interstate child placement here. Kansas said, you know, 3 times, no. And in the record, there's one that, the only one that I found really in the record, but the one that I found in the record says, we're concerned about her emotional stability and she will not let the child see the natural father. Now, I have to talk about the natural father because this is a big deal. You don't necessarily get it from just reading the transcript, but this is a big deal. She lived with the natural father. Well, she didn't. There's a dispute. She told, at one point, she said she lived with him several months. Another time she said, no, she didn't live with him. She was living with a friend and she just went over there. Okay. Well, the problem is, she told service providers early on, she didn't know who the natural father was. Okay, so they had to do paternity testing, and they found out it was Mr. Jones. And so they pursued the possibility with Mr. Jones. But she is adamant that he sexually abused her and that she cannot let the child see Mr. Jones. Now, this is big, and you'll find it in the record. You'll find in there the flyer that she put together that she gave to a service provider that says, help, seriously urgent. Can anybody help me? Because there's a conspiracy. It's Mr. Jones and, you know, the Children's Division and so on are working against me, and Cass County authorities won't prosecute the father. Well, she didn't file a report of rape until 2 years after the event, after the court had taken jurisdiction. Now, why do I say it's a big deal? I say it's a big deal because this is a cogent theory of what's going on with this woman. Now, she's not a bad woman. She's afflicted. You don't have to be a bad person to have parental rights terminated. But she still believes many things, both persecutorial delusions and grandiose delusions.
Can you address whether the basis on which the court found those are still in place today or still provided a reason to terminate her rights today? Based on 2009?
And
opposing counsel mentions in his brief that he gave her back custody for those few months after this event occurred, and he says that indicates that the court didn't think that incident in itself was enough. What changed the court's mind on the permanency?
Well, the main thing that changed the court's mind on the permanency was when Commissioner Allen asked her, said she needed to let the child see Mr. Jones, and she would not. She said, I will bring the child back. Now, she told a service provider that she thought if she threw a fit or took a position, that would help the child. The commissioner saw it as the commissioner who'd already talked to Mr. Jones. Service providers had talked to Jones. They'd interacted with him. Nobody thought this man was a rapist. Nobody except her. She told one service provider that her mother, with whom she has a bad relationship, she says she doesn't know where her mother lives now, her mother and Mr. Jones are part of a big organization like the KKK or the Mafia. And that's in the record. That's what she told a service provider.
When was this during the time when after 2009 when the child was?
There are events going up to 2011 where she thought she was stalked at a storage locker. She thought her landlady was tampering with her food. She thought that people were breaking into her apartment.
So you're saying it's not based on a single delusional incident?
It is not based on a single delusional incident. The delusions continue. Now, if you meet this lady and you interview her in a structured setting, she presents well, and she's been educated. She's had an attorney throughout the proceedings. She also was overheard by a service provider saying that if I had known earlier what I know now, I would have kept my mouth shut. Well, she didn't always keep her mouth shut with the service providers. She did with the authoritative people like Dr. Golan and so on. Dr. Golan, by the way, which they rely on, Dr. Golan admitted he had 10 to 12 visits with her, 15 minutes each. She presents well, and you have to understand, she's probably in the right situation, a nice person. But here's what happened in this case. The language which we sometimes use in these cases, that clear, cogent, and convincing evidence, is evidence that instantly tilts the scales toward revocation when the other evidence is considered. First of all, that instantly tilt the scales language has a questionable pedigree. It was never propounded by this court. It was never propounded by the Missouri legislature. It's drawn from an attorney discipline case in New Mexico. And there's no reason to believe the due process clause requires the instantly tilt.
This court has repeated that.
Yes.
Adopted it many times.
This court has used it. But also this court has usually followed it with language designed to preserve deference to the trial court's credibility findings. This court, in this case, as an example...
It doesn't interpret it very differently than a preponderance.
That's right. And the word instantly is very problematic in my view. It tends to suggest that the reviewing court can be the super jury to substitute its judgment for that of the trial court instead of simply determining whether a reasonable fact finder could have reasonably been highly persuaded by evidence to the point of believing it was clear, cogent, and
isn't convinced. That statement more akin to the way we would review even beyond a reasonable doubt in the criminal setting? The statement or the phraseology that you just used
shows up very similar,
even at reviewing a
higher
trial burden.
It's addressed to the fact finder primarily, and this court in the Van Orden case involving the sexually violent predator case said, we'll instruct the jury on clear, cogent, convincing evidence, or clear and convincing evidence. We'll tell them that. That's the instruction. But we're not going to give them this instantly tilts the scales thing.
Switching gears just a little bit, the evidence regarding her financial support to the child during the pendency of this action, the trial court found was de minimis. What did the trial court find, or what evidence was there that she would be unlikely or unable to support the child financially in the future?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the answer to that question is this lady has had, in the 3 years before her interrogatory answers were filled out, she had seven jobs. She had seven changes of addresses. She had eight jobs since 2000. Between 2004 and 2008, she had eight jobs. Since 2008, she hasn't had any job that was more than perhaps close to a year at most. Most were a few months at a time. When Kansas said, oh, she's doing great, when they said that, they said, oh, well, she's got a great support system, and she really understands the legal system. And they said she was doing great then. I don't know who the support system was that they saw. Some of the support system is aid that she's gotten, and she's applied for loans to go to school so she could live off a part of that. But I don't know, there's no consistent support system. At the time of trial, she had an arrangement that was addressing her needs. But seven changes of addresses within 3 years before the interrogatory answers, eight different jobs, mostly minimum wage, one was $10 an hour, and she complained of cooks tampering with her food. She complained of someone sent to harass her. These are in the service reports. A lot of times we just don't know why the job ended. We just don't know. And at times she's applied for unemployment. We don't know what's happened on the unemployment compensation. It's not in the record. But Your Honors, I have prepared a summary of my remarks, and one of the things that I have looked at is the history of the instantly tilts the scales language, and it's important that the court consider that, because in this case, the court said under our standard of, this is the Court of Appeals, which I really understand that it's not about whether they got it right, but I just, as an example of the fact that courts can go astray with that instantly tilts language, they says we must resolve conflicting evidence in favor of the trial court's judgment. However, the standard of review also requires reversal unless the trial court's decision is supported by evidence that instantly tilts the scales in favor of termination when weighed against the evidence in opposition.
Counsel, no. Your time has expired.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
Chief Justice, I have my appellate argument in a form here that contains my remarks, and I can give that to you. Mr. Murray has a copy if there's no objection.
I would raise the new arguments that weren't in the brief, specifically, especially as flipping the evidence that was never briefed. The briefs stand, the arguments stand. There is no need for other written response that we haven't had a chance to review, look at, or respond to be presented with yet.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Smart. We've got good briefing and a great argument today. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to quickly clarify that you asked a question earlier about whether Kansas evidence had been presented. And I said there was one, but there was actually much more. There's testimony from Lindsay Johnson, the KBC social worker, Peggy Hitchcock, the CASA worker in Kansas, plus records. There is a large amount of evidence of what happened in Kansas. The other quick point I'd like to make, based on Judge Smart's previous comments, most of that, quite a large number of it, is nowhere to be found in the trial court's findings and recommendations.
Was it part of the record?
It was in the record,
doesn't Rule 73 state that all findings of fact not specifically found are found in accordance with the judgment?
That's correct, but...
So you'd have us ignore it rather than assume the trial court considered it.
I would, on a termination case, where the court is making specific findings to find a termination, if there's no evidence...
There's required statutory findings, and if you think that there aren't sufficient findings, you can request specific findings of fact and conclusions. Did you do that in this case?
No. No, we did not. I would also like to quickly address and make a point that stable, continuous employment has never been, and it's never been, no court that I've found has required stable employment or continuous employment as a standard for keeping your children. The fact that mother has had a job history, a lengthy job history, is not on its own grounds for termination. There is also much of that evidence, or much of the argument that we just heard. Again, there was no connection, as there was done, no connection by the trial court, of the likelihood of future harm, of how these acts, how these past behavior, how this past pattern, there needs to be an explicit consideration as to how those acts and how that conduct could likely harm the child in the future. And yet again, here we have mother who is sufficiently caring for her son at the time of the termination hearing.
Did your client have any diagnosis of schizophrenia or any other kind of mental disease or defect?
In the record, some of the people who saw her, especially around 2009, there were a lot of different diagnoses thrown about. Her psychiatrist testified that his diagnosis as of the time of the termination hearing, which was that she had suffered from a delusional episode, perhaps brought on by postpartum depression. And she also, I think, had a PTSD diagnosis.
But then she's been treated since then. Has there been a more recent diagnosis made of her since that first diagnosis at the time of the delusions?
Yes, Dr. Golan and his diagnosis.
And that's the most recent, and is that the only diagnosis?
he testified the month before the hearing and explained his diagnosis and his current diagnosis of mother in his testimony.
Schizophrenia was mentioned at some point in the medical records, though.
That's correct. Right. But it was not found by Dr. Golan. Dr. Golan testified at the time of the termination hearing that he did not believe she had suffered from that and explained what his medical diagnosis at that time. Okay. And I'm out of time. If anyone has any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.